granting summary judgment on plaintiff's Section 1983 claims. And the reason is because the defendant, Pritchett, did violate Hunt's Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable seizures. The Third Circuit announced the standard for analyzing unlawful seizure claims in the school setting in the Schuman versus Penn Manor School District case. And Schuman looked to the previous United States Supreme Court decision in New Jersey versus TLO for that reasonableness standard. And therefore, we believe it is appropriate to look at the standards that were announced in the TLO case as well as in the Schuman case in analyzing the claims in this case. In the TLO case, the court, in analyzing an unlawful search under the Fourth Amendment, said that first the search must be justified at its inception, which means that there must be reasonable grounds for suspecting that the search will result in evidence that the student violated or is violating a law or a school rule. And secondly, the TLO court said that the search as conducted must be reasonably related in scope to the circumstances that justified it. In other words, the measures adopted must be reasonably related to the objectives of the search, and the search must not be excessively intrusive in light of the age and sex of the child and in light of the nature of the infraction. So, again, it is our position that these standards can be applied in analyzing an unlawful seizure claim as well, which is what we have in this case. And when those standards are applied to this case, it is clear that the seizure of Anthony Hunt was unreasonable given the circumstances that were then existing and apparent. First of all, the seizure was not justified at its inception because Defendant Pritchett had no reason to believe that the seizure of Anthony Hunt would result in evidence that Anthony Hunt had violated a law or school rule. First of all, Mr. McDowell, the principal of the school, had informed Mr. Pritchett that a student we will refer to as AB, and we have referred to as AB, that student had taken the money. Principal McDowell instructed Defendant Pritchett to interview AB and only AB. Principal McDowell did not authorize Defendant Pritchett to interrogate Anthony Hunt. And here I'd like to point out a factual detail here that may be unclear in some of the briefing. The defendant implies that Principal McDowell was aware that Defendant Pritchett was interrogating or was questioning Anthony Hunt. But that is not clear from the evidence. In fact, when you examine Principal McDowell's testimony, it is clear that, at least it is his position, that he was not at all aware that Defendant Pritchett was questioning Anthony Hunt.
Well, at a minimum, you would say these material facts are in dispute?
Yes, they're in dispute. McDowell says that he didn't even know what Anthony Hunt looked like and that he certainly was not aware that Pritchett was interviewing or questioning Anthony Hunt, because at page 50 of our appendix, he says that he profusely apologized to Ms. DeSombre because he wasn't aware that Pritchett was questioning Anthony Hunt. Another factor that goes to showing that the seizure was not justified at its inception is that Pritchett did not believe that Anthony had taken the money. He testified this at page A76 of our appendix. He said, I didn't think Anthony had taken the money. Well, I was 99% sure that he hadn't taken the money. He had really no belief, or nothing more than a 1% belief, that Anthony may have taken the money. According to Pritchett, AB told him that another child, not AB himself, had taken the money. And here there's another important factual clarification that needs to be made. AB did not identify Anthony by name. when he was being questioned by Pritchett. He merely referred to this other child that he supposedly accused of taking the money as someone in the seat with him. And when Pritchett examined the seating chart, he actually found out that there were three people sitting in the seat. So he was not able to determine that Anthony was the other person sitting in the seat. And that's at page A74. But another interesting fact, the defendants have included an interview of A.B., apparently by some school officials, in their appendix. And at page B104 of the defendant's appendix, A.B. told these school administrators that he thought it was, quote, weird that Anthony was in the interview with that he participated in with Officer Pritchett. If A.B. had accused Anthony of taking the money, why would he think it was weird? His words were, I thought it was weird that Anthony was in the interview because I knew that he hadn't done anything wrong. So we have the distinct possibility that Defendant Pritchett actually made up this supposed fact that A.B. had accused someone else of taking the money in order to justify his interrogation of Anthony. Something else that goes to showing that the seizure was not justified at its inception is that it was not justified it was not justified as an examination of a potential witness. First of all, when you look at the actual transcript of Anthony's testimony, specifically at page A92, it's very clear that when Pritchett brought him in and began to examine him, he was examining him as a suspect, not as a potential witness. He told him 11 or 12 times in the first 5 minutes of the interview or the interrogation that if he didn't tell the truth, that this money had been stolen, and if he didn't tell the truth, that Pritchett had the authority to arrest him and put him in jail. He obviously was not examining him as a potential witness. But even if you say that he was, one of the cases cited by the defendant, the Camara case, states, it is surely anomalous to say that an individual and his private property are fully protected by the Fourth Amendment only when the individual is suspected of criminal behavior. So in other words, even if Anthony is somehow viewed as only a potential witness and not a suspect in this case, he is still entitled to the protections of the Fourth Amendment. Moving to the second phase of the Schuman TLO analysis, the measures that Pritchett adopted in his interrogation were not reasonably related to the objectives of the search, and they were also excessively intrusive in light of the age and sex of Anthony, or in light of his age in particular, and the nature of the infraction. Anthony was an 8-year-old boy who was being interrogated for an hour over the theft of $1. He was interrogated in a closed room by a fully uniformed officer who was wearing his utility belt and his handcuffs. He was interrogated without the knowledge or consent of his parents, even though Pritchett conceded that this violated established procedures. That's at pages 85 and 88 of our appendix.
Now, established procedure means what? Police protocols?
Rules and regulations? Apparently, the established procedures of the school. Pritchett testified that he was aware that parents were to be contacted if their child was being questioned.
But we don't know with certainty whether he's talking about internal rules and regulations of his department or whether we're talking about school or school district rules, as he is euphemistically called a resource officer?
Your Honor, I'm not certain. I would think that he was talking about school rules and school policies, but, Your Honor, I'm not certain about that. Not only was Anthony interrogated without the knowledge or consent of his parents, but he was interrogated without the knowledge or consent of school administrators. Again, going back to McDowell's testimony, that he knew nothing about the interrogation and that he did not even know what Anthony looked like.
Well, this may not be a a real big point in the whole matter, but how could you say that it was without the knowledge and consent of the school when it took place in a room that seemed to be right in the middle of everything, that people would know that this was going on?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, while it took place in the school, McDowell, Principal McDowell, had only authorized Pritchett to question A.B. and had told him specifically to question A.B. Because Principal McDowell says that he was completely unaware of the interrogation, one has to assume that Pritchett, at least according to McDowell, had interrogated Anthony without the knowledge or permission of McDowell. Now, apparently there was a teacher who brought Anthony down to be questioned by Officer Pritchett, who asked if she could stay, and Pritchett told her no. But it's only Pritchett's testimony that says that McDowell was aware that he was questioning Anthony. If we go with McDowell's testimony, there was apparently no awareness by school administrators that Pritchett was questioning
Would
Anthony.
Would there be anything inherently wrong with questioning a child before being given specific instructions to do so?
Inherently wrong.
In the sense that, you know, does that constitute some violation in and of itself? Oh, you know, you weren't specifically instructed to interrogate this child, therefore you have violated his constitutional rights.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe it's part of the reasonableness analysis. I don't know if we could make a statement that it would always be wrong for a school resource officer to question a child without first going to school administrators. But in the context of this situation, where Principal McDowell had specifically instructed Pritchett to question A.B. and only A.B. and had told Pritchett that A.B. was the one who had taken the money.
Right, except, you know, when you say and only A.B., you make it sound as if the instructions were, Pritchett, I want you to interrogate A.B. I don't want you to interrogate anyone else in the school. And that's not the way it played out. It was that Pritchett undertook to do more than what, or arguably, to do more than what he was instructed to do, but not necessarily anything inconsistent with what he was instructed to do.
Your Honor, I understand what you're saying, but I believe you can see from McDowell's reaction to the knowledge that Pritchett had interrogated Anthony, he profusely apologized to Anthony's mother. He told her he had no idea that Defendant Pritchett was questioning Anthony. If this had been part of some kind of general authorization, why would McDowell have had that type of reaction where he was profusely apologizing to the child's mother that Pritchett had questioned him? I believe that implies that Pritchett did not have the authority to do so. And again, I think this is part of this entire reasonableness analysis. In addition, going to the methods chosen and whether they were appropriate or, on the other hand, excessively intrusive, during the first 5 minutes, as I said, of the interview or the interrogation, Anthony was told 11 or 12 times that Pritchett had the authority to arrest him, put him in jail. He didn't tell the truth. He told Anthony that he talked to him about going to Stevenson House where people were mean, where it was a holding place for the, quote, real prison for kids. He told him that if he were at Stevenson, his siblings would wonder, would be upset, would not be able to see him. His plaintiffs would say that his parents would say that he was bad. Another factual point I think that's important is to say that the plaintiff was told he was not in trouble before the interrogation began is misleading, because if you look at the plaintiff's testimony at page 95 of our appendix, at Anthony's testimony, he said, yes, he was told that he was not in trouble before the interrogation began, but from the questioning 11 or 12 times telling him he would be put in jail, that he then knew that or felt that he was in trouble. Now, moving on to the qualified immunity analysis, of course, that's a two-pronged test, and I think we've established that a Fourth Amendment right to be free from unlawful seizure was violated in this case. In addition, at the time of the violation, the right was clearly established. Both TLO and the Schuman case had been decided, TLO in 1985, the Schuman case in 2005, prior to this incident. And moving on to the common law claims, we also believe that the court below erred in dismissing or granting summary judgment on plaintiff's common law claims. Intentional infliction of emotional distress. In the Mattern decision, then Judge Chandler stated that where reasonable men might differ, it is for a jury to determine whether the conduct alleged has been sufficiently extreme and outrageous to result in liability. It's interesting that the court below, this is at page 9 of the court's opinion, stated that with respect to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, that it, the court, would not substitute its discretion for that of Pritchett with regard to the techniques that were used to interrogate Anthony. But in this case, it really should be the jury that is given the discretion to decide whether Officer Pritchett's conduct was outrageous in this circumstance, again, where you have a fully uniformed police officer taking an 8-year-old child into a closed room, interrogating him for an hour, telling him numerous times he would be arrested, put in jail if he did not tell the truth, threatening him with incarceration in Stevenson House, and so forth. It really should be up to a jury to determine whether that conduct qualifies as outrageous. Moving to the false arrest and false imprisonment claims, the court below said that there was no false imprisonment or false arrest because an objectively reasonable person would feel, that who was in Anthony's situation, would feel that he would feel free to leave. And I really assert to the court that this is not the case. An 8-year-old child in a closed room with a fully uniformed police officer, fully armed police officer, telling him 11 or 12 times in the first 5 minutes that he will put him in jail and arrest him if he does not tell the truth.
Excuse me, on this point about what an objective person would believe,
yes.
Is that a question that a jury can determine, or is it strictly a matter of law?
Your Honor, I believe this is something that a jury has to evaluate. In other words, a jury would be instructed on the law, but I do believe that as a matter of law, the court could decide that a person in Anthony's situation would not feel free to leave in this situation. And in addition, the JDB court in 2000, I think it was 2011, the United States Supreme Court said that in determining these types of, or making these types of custody determinations, a child's age should be taken into account. So again, in this situation where you have a very young child in a closed room.
Right. I understand that there are a whole bunch of factors to look at, including
yes.
age and so forth. But what I'm asking is that a determination that is made by the court or by the jury?
It's made by the jury, Your Honor, once the jury has determined what the facts are. Because since the jury is the fact finder, the jury must determine Officer Pritchett does have a somewhat different account of the nature of the interrogation and the length of the interrogation and so forth, but a jury would have to determine, Your Honor, whether a reasonable child of 8 years old in this situation would feel free to leave, having determined what the facts actually were. And because the facts are unsettled, summary judgment should not have been granted on the false imprisonment claim in this case.
Mr. Primus, you only have about 30 seconds left of your rebuttal time. Are you aware of that?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I thought.
Do you want to save that 30 seconds?
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong clock. yes, I would like to. I apologize, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mark Nijelski on behalf of the defendants below, and we ask that you affirm the Superior Court's decision in this matter. And I do agree with my opponent that the Schuman case is, I think, an excellent place to start and end the 1983 claims. And that simply is because the first question you have to decide is, was there a seizure? And in the Schuman case, they tell us what's required for a seizure. And it has to be objectively, and it, what a person individually believes, what Anthony believes or feels or is not the issue. The issue is what would an objective person on the outside. Now, in the Schuman case, they determined there had been a seizure in that case where the student was placed in a room for 4 hours while they made inquiry about a sexual misconduct with another student. However, in that case, the student was told he had to stay there and could not move. Despite that, the Schuman court still found that in all the circumstances, it was a reasonable inquiry. It was reasonable what the administrators did. It's not probable cause. It's not reasonable suspicion. It's some low, very low, hybrid standard called reasonableness. In this particular case, Pritchard is called to the school about a problem involving a bullying incident involving an autistic student on the bus. The assistant principal...
Before you get into these facts, tell me what you wanted us to take away from your explanation of Schuman. That in Schuman, where the student was told to stay there, a reasonable person would not feel free to leave. But in our case, since no one ever told Hunt, stay here, he knew he was free to leave.
Well, there was no suggestion that he couldn't leave. I mean, that is given to us by an inference, Your Honor.
My question is really simple. You're citing Schuman, you're distinguishing the facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just tell me your point.
That's the point, Your Honor. Is in Schuman, that student was actually told he had to stay there. So he knew, and objectively you could say, he's not free to leave.
So the point here is no one ever told Hunt. The police officer sitting in the closed room in uniform between Hunt and the door, but Hunt knows he's free to leave because no one ever told him he wasn't free to leave.
Well, Your Honor, that's the analysis, I believe. It's an objective analysis.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay.
And in any event, the reason that Mr. Hunt got involved in this and had any contact with Pritchard is when Pritchard went in to speak with A.B., who Mr. McDowell thought to be the perpetrator, he said, well, yeah, I got the dollar at home, but I didn't take it. Somebody else took it. Somebody sitting in the seat behind me. So Pritchard went to the office, got the seating chart for that bus, made a determination that he was speaking of the plaintiff, Anthony Hunt.
Well, was there a single seat behind him?
I believe it was a double seat, Your Honor. But in any event, he was able
What's
to...
What's this business about three people in the seat?
I don't know that. I don't know that, Your Honor. But in any event...
Is that in dispute?
Well, it's not in dispute that Anthony Hunt sat behind this individual whom the money was taken from. That's not in dispute.
And it's not in dispute that A.B. didn't say Anthony Hunt.
He did not say Anthony Hunt.
And he didn't tell Pritchett that there was somebody in the seat behind him.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was more than one person at a minimum.
Well, in any event, Your Honor, Pritchett was...
Yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor. But it was determined, Pritchett determined that he was speaking of Anthony Hunt. So
how do you just intuit that?
No, Your Honor, there's something more to it that I may be missing myself, Your Honor. But I believe it wasn't like he didn't just take a chance that this was the guy. And then he called...
I thought not only didn't he, whether he took a chance or not, he testified that he was 99% sure it was A.B.
Yes, Your Honor, but then I.E.B. tells him, oh, no, I didn't take it. Somebody else gave it to me. That guy behind me gave it to me. I didn't take it. I have it, but I didn't take it.
I hear you, but as far as the record is concerned, the interrogator testified that he was interrogating someone when he was 99% certain it was somebody else.
And he wanted that somebody else, A.B., to admit the truth, that in fact he was the one that took the money.
So he was using Hunt as a tool.
In a way, yes, Your Honor. He was confronting him with
a boy.
What's that?
An 8-year-old boy he was using as a tool.
Well, he was getting the two protagonists, if you will, in the same room and to see if our friend A.B. would finally admit the truth, which he did.
What was Hunt protagonistic about?
Well, Your Honor, in fact, he was Officer Pritchett believed that he was the one who A.B. was blaming for taking the money.
That's what's confusing. The officer thinks that Hunt is being blamed.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the same officer is 99% certain Hunt did not do it.
That's correct.
So, as the Chief Justice said, the purpose of bringing Hunt into the room was to use him for some purpose to get to the truth.
Well, I wouldn't use the word use, but to confront him to confront A.B. with the person he believed he was blaming.
All right, just tell us how you would describe Hunt's role.
Hunt was brought in there, Your Honor, to get A.B. to admit the truth that he, in fact, was the one that took the dollar, number one, and nobody else was involved, to exonerate Hunt.
So if I'm understanding the scenario, Pritchett decided that A.B. would be upset to see Hunt accused of something that A.B. had actually done. And so Pritchett went really hard on Hunt in A.B.'s presence so that A.B. would say, whoa, wait a second, you know, this poor kid is crying, he didn't do it, I did it. And that was the game plan.
I think it was to confront him, was confront A.B. with Anthony, and get A.B. to admit the truth of what he did.
And part of the way to do that is to have Hunt be very upset and be treated roughly so that A.B. would feel badly about it.
No, because I think before they went in this reading lab, Trooper Pritchett talked to Plaintiff Hunt and said, listen, essentially you're not in any trouble. And the only reason you're here is because you were in the seat that this guy says.
Well, what Mr. Primo said, though, is that as things evolved, while Hunt might have walked in thinking he wasn't in any trouble, when they started talking about arresting him and going to Stevenson, Hunt thought things had taken a turn for the worse as far as he was concerned.
I think the conversation was made not just to Mr. Hunt, but to A.B. as well.
All right, well, tell us why all of this is reasonable as it relates to Mr. Hunt.
Because, Your Honor, he was blamed by A.B. indirectly as being a perpetrator, okay? So it's reasonable for the trooper to get Mr. Hunt to attempt, because he believed that it was A.B. that did it, and get him to exonerate Mr. Hunt at the same time to admit the truth that he had taken the money himself.
Okay.
Your Honor, as to the state law claims, the battery claim is puzzling to me. Mr. Hunt testified he was never touched. Pritchett testified he did touch him on the wrist. And I don't understand how that survived. If he doesn't say he was touched, it must have been so minimalistic, it can't be a battery. It can't be offensive. Second thing about what arrest is, and false arrest in Delaware, is we're lucky that we have a statute, a criminal statute, which specifically defines what an arrest is. And what happened to Mr. Hunt was not an arrest. I mean, if you look objectively back, Mr. Hunt was not put in handcuffs. No proceedings were commenced against Mr. Hunt. He returned to his class after the incident. He wasn't arrested, he wasn't charged, he wasn't handcuffed. None of the things that you normally see in a criminal justice case, none of those things. And he certainly was not arrested.
Well, this is a summary judgment case. And tell us why there are no issues of material fact.
Because the questions that are presented here are legal questions. Was there a seizure? If there was a seizure, was it reasonable? And secondly, if there was a seizure and it wasn't reasonable, would Pritchett still be entitled to qualified immunity? And I suggest to you the Schuman case makes it clear that he would be entitled to qualified immunity because it's not clearly established that what he did was wrong or violated the Fourth Amendment.
Did I miss your attention to the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim?
Oh, no, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I just think that the Superior Court got that right. I mean, this is not so outrageous of circumstances that I think there's an intentional infliction of emotional distress. First of all, it's clear that Pritchett was not trying to upset the young man, Mr. Hunt. He was trying to do quite the opposite. He was trying to get A.B. to admit that he took the money and to exonerate Mr. Hunt. So clearly,
well, is there a difference between the effectiveness of the interrogation in terms of what it caused A.B. to do and what the nature of the interrogation caused Hunt's reaction?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's not an uncommon interviewing technique to when a perpetrator claims that somebody else did something.
Is it common to have a uniformed armed police officer interview an 8-year-old without notifying their parents?
Your Honor.
I'm
sorry.
Or without allowing a teacher in the room when the interview takes place in a school?
I think
Telling us that's commonplace?
No, it's not, Your Honor. I think that the policy is to have a parent or a teacher available.
Whose policy?
The state police policy.
So we're talking about departmental internal rules and regulations?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're not talking about school or school district?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Now, the school district may have their own set of policies, but the state police have a policy about interviewing suspects that are under the age. However, I think Pritchett's mind was, this guy didn't do it, and let's get this taken care of as quickly as possible and send him on his way.
So innocent people have less protections than suspects?
No, Your Honor. We don't know he's innocent until A.B. admits that he was the one that took the money and that Hunt had nothing to do with it.
We're only 99% sure of it.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is the state police policy in the record?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. But the state police...
Is that something we can take judicial notice of? I mean, is it a type of public record?
It is not.
If we find it, we can say, well, we can take judicial notice?
It is not a public record. It is not a public record. I would point out that whether they have a policy or not, that doesn't affect the analysis regarding a 1983 allegation, which is based strictly on federal law. In other words, that may be a basis for Pritchett to be disciplined by his supervisor, but that's not necessarily a basis for a civil suit, and it's certainly not a basis for a right under Section 1983.
Is it a basis to use in trying to analyze the reasonableness of his actions?
I think the Schuman Court tells us that we analyze it without any of those things, because the Schuman Court doesn't use any of that to analyze whether there was a seizure in their particular case and what was reasonable in the circumstances. They didn't relate or rely on police policy or internal regulations or anything like that.
All right, well, tell us why it's reasonable to bring a person who you are 99% sure had nothing to do with it into an interrogation room with the suspect with the intention of making the suspect feel so much sympathy for Hunt that the suspect is going to confess. Why is that reasonable?
I think it is reasonable. I think that is a fairly standard interviewing technique, Your Honor.
And you would generate the sympathy for Hunt by making Hunt either look guilty or uncomfortable.
No, you're making A.B. confess by knowing that he's now involved in another person, which he said had something to do with this, and he's now feeling very awkward because now he wants to admit the truth because now he's feeling very awkward.
The catalyst for A.B.'s admission was readily observable emotional distress on Hunt's part, wasn't it?
I don't think it's emotional distress in that manner, Your Honor. I think he was bringing Hunt into the room.
People break out crying because they don't like the color of the sky?
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't think he actually was crying. I think he said there were tears in his eyes, but I don't think there's any indication he was actually crying. He was starting to look like he was getting upset, and Pritchett did apologize.
Is that consistent with being distressed emotionally?
Well, to some extent, Your Honor.
And were the words that the police officer directed at Hunt intended to produce a reaction that would cause AB to admit the crime? And could that reaction have been emotional distress?
It's possible, Your Honor. But I think...
Isn't that what happened here?
No, I think we was focused more on AB, Your Honor.
But isn't Hunt's emotional distress readily observable and served as the catalyst for the reaction the police officer wanted from AB?
All I know is, Your Honor, is after he brought in Mr. Hunt, AB did admit, I was not there, AB did admit that he was the one that took the money and thereby exonerated Hunt.
I understand that, but isn't it possible that a jury, a rational juror, could infer from these facts that the police officer intended to put Hunt in a position where he was so emotionally distressed that it would serve as the catalyst for AB to admit his crime?
That was not argued below, Your Honor. I don't know.
Well, what is the emotional distress count all about if it wasn't argued below?
I think the emotional distress was the fact that he was brought in that reading lab room and he was asked questions.
So if he had asked questions, how are you doing in arithmetic? Why are you dressed the way you are today? How do you get along with your parents? Do you have a lot of friends in school? None of those kinds of questions were asked. Questions were asked, if you don't tell the truth, I'm armed, I'm in uniform, I can arrest you, I can send you to the Stevenson house. Your siblings and your parents are going to think you're a bad person if you don't tell the truth. The mere fact he was asked questions, or was it the nature of the questions and the surrounding environment and circumstances under which they were asked, intended to provoke a reaction that would serve as the catalyst for AB to confess?
I think the reaction that was being sought was the reaction from AB, not from Hunt. AB made a comment where he implicated someone else as him not taking it. And I think the officer has to follow up that lead.
Yeah,
that
the officer's hopeful outcome was that AB would resolve any question about who stole the dollar. I understand that. But the questions and the way in which they were asked, could not a jury reasonably infer were intended to provoke a reaction from Hunt that was emotional enough to spur AB to react by confessing?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean,
why do you not think a reasonable juror could reach that conclusion on this disputed set of facts?
Because, Your Honor, Mr. Hunt is in his school. He's there every day. If he's not in one room, he's in another room. The fact that he was in an awkward situation for him and he was getting emotionally upset, I don't think you could say from that was what Pritchett wanted to do. Because that question was never asked to Pritchett.
You don't think so, and I might not think so. But my question is, could not a reasonable juror draw that inference from these facts?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I still don't think, even if they did draw that inference, it's such outrageous conduct that's required for intentional infliction of emotional distress. I mean, the question of intentional infliction of emotional distress is, what was Pritchett's intention? Was it to cause Anthony Hunt to get so upset? I don't think it was. And there's nothing in the record to suggest it was.
Well, if he thought 99% Hunt wasn't implicated, why was he talking to Hunt about being arrested, Stevenson, what his parents and his siblings would thought?
The conversation that took place was in the reading lab. That was with AB and Hunt. I think those comments were directed to AB, because prior to going in the reading lab where AB was, he told Hunt, don't worry about it, you're not in any trouble.
Well, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that the two boys are in the room with Pritchett, and Pritchett is trying to induce AB to fess up. So Pritchett starts slapping Hunt around, you know, whacking him in the face and saying, you know, you better tell me the truth, son, you better tell me this truth, and hits him a few more times. But he's only doing it because he wants AB to see that and feel bad and confess. Would that be acceptable?
Oh, that would not be acceptable. If he were hitting him, absolutely not. Of course, we know that never happened.
No, but so you're saying that somewhere between slapping him and verbally abusing him and causing him great distress, somewhere between there is the line that makes it not go to the jury?
Your Honor, I think the reason why you're there is very important, too, because you've got to remember, I mean, he was called to come there by the assistant principal. Pritchard didn't go there on his own. He is the school resource officer. He's taken over from somebody else during this period of time. And he's dealt with these situations before. I've got to believe that he kind of knows what he's doing, and there's nothing that he did that is so outrageous. I mean, it's true the kid was 8 years old. But
and it's true that there are departmental rules and regulations that say he's supposed to call the parent.
If
he knows what he's doing, why didn't he do that?
Your Honor, if I may, I haven't read the rule in a while, but I believe the rule goes something to the effect if you're going to charge or going to do an interview where you may get charging information, then you need to contact a parent or guardian or something like that. I don't think he brought him in there for that purpose. I thought he brought him in there to quickly get A.B. to concede that he was the one that did it and to exonerate Hunt from it.
When you use the word quickly, what's your position factually on how long this interview process took place?
Well, the plaintiff testified 55 minutes, so we're using 55 minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, regarding this theory, which I don't think I've heard before, that Anthony was supposedly brought in to make A.B. confess, I think when the court examines the record, and specifically page 92, A92 of our appendix, it's clear, at least from Anthony's recollection, that he was in the room alone with Officer Pritchett for a period of time before A.B. was brought in. He says, "We sat down. He asked me if I took this money. He told me 11 or 12 times that he would arrest me, put me in jail if I didn't tell the truth." And then the question came, "What else happened?" And Anthony's response, "And then after that," and then it's deleted, but I believe it's a reference to A.B., "was called from the office into there."
Thank you, Mr. Primus.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.